episode 70 of the Planning Period Podcast, your Ed Breakroom. I'm your host, Brad Schreffler. This week on the show, I'm joined by Michael Ralph, a STEM teacher trainer within the You Can Teach program at the University of Kansas. He focuses on the scientific process for others to be able to bring that into their own classroom. He's also the host of the Two Pint PLC podcast, where he and his co-host, Lawrence Woodruff, discuss educational research while drinking a pint of beer. How cool is that? Michael and I talk about educational research and what teachers should do with it, the differences between K-12 and college education, professionalism of educators and where it is lacking internally and externally, why teachers don't reflect enough on their practice, what true reflective practice looks like, the role of planning on the teaching and reflection process, and the need for teachers to have a general understanding of educational research and theory. This week, I am going to ask for a favor if you're listening. If you like and enjoy the show, if you could do me a favor and rate the show on iTunes or whatever podcast app you're using to listen to the show, I'd really appreciate it. That is a way to help get some exposure and get some other people listening to the show. Or if you don't want to rate it, share it with someone else. Send them one of the episodes or send them some information and say, hey, you should really check out this show. If you're finding value in it, the most important thing you can do is pass it along. It's how we make each other better, and it's how you help continue to make this show grow. But for now, sit back and enjoy episode 70 of the Planning Period Podcast, my interview with Michael Ralph. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Planning Period Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Brad Schreffler, and I'm joined today by a fellow podcaster, one of two hosts of a show called the Two Pint PLC, which I really enjoy. They take a very in-depth look at educational research for the most part, and they do some interesting guests and discuss things. But what I really mostly like about their show is that every episode they drink a beer. And in honor of that, Michael, I'm going to go ahead and just do this. There we go. I had mine ready to go. Who cares that it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon? Let's just go for it. And for the children listening at home, that was actually a Diet Coke. But my guest today is Mr. Michael Ralph. How you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I'm glad to have you here. For my audience who doesn't know you and now just thinks you're an alcoholic who talks about education, could you maybe tell them a little bit about who you are?
Yeah, I'm not going to say that that's wrong, but maybe I can add in some additional context. I train STEM teachers at the University of Kansas. That's my day job. I got a couple of degrees in biology, and so my primary focus is teaching the research methods course within the You Can Teach program. And so I'm really, my primary activity is helping pre-service teachers understand the complexities of the scientific process and how to engage in inquiry so that they can then build those experiences into their classroom whenever they go on and get a place where they can teach of their own. And so that's really, that's what I do.
Nice. And I think that value in the scientific process and the research process definitely shows through in your podcast.
I hope so. It's something, you know, it's sort of how I landed there. I taught in a high school classroom for 8 years in the Kansas City area, teaching all manner of biologies. And I think one of the things that we have to struggle with in our classroom a whole bunch is, you know, frequently we want to say, here's how it would look for real, but we can't do that for reason X or for reason Y. You know, there's a time constraint, there's a material constraint. And so it feels like too often we have to say, we're going to do this approximation of the authentic process. And so I think that it's important for us as teachers to remember what that authentic process looks like when we can devote the time and the resources to it. So being able to say, okay, we're going to set that aside. Let's do it. Let's really do a piece of science here so that then we can make sure that we're providing those experiences for our students, I think is important, because if we always hand wave over it, then we can kind of lose sight of that goal after a while.
Yeah, I like that. It's good. And, you know, that was one of the things other than the beer that drove me to your podcast is that very deep look. And I think with what I like about your podcast is you guys don't just say, well, this is research-based best practices. You say, well, what is the research really telling us? And from some of the episodes I've listened to, you guys will regularly disagree with the conclusions that are made of the research. And I think that critical lens is very powerful for a lot of us when in an age where I think research-based is kind of thrown around as a catch-all in education.
I agree. That's a conversation that I don't think that we have enough. Sometimes research becomes this weapon to wield of people who want to claim authority on a topic. And that's not the appropriate use of it. And that's actually one of my favorite things about my relationship with my co-host Lawrence, is we're so fond of disagreeing with each other that, you know, in our professional practice, we'd end up saying, well, here's what this piece of literature says. You'd come back and say, well, this is my analysis of the data, and here's my alternative citation. And we really enjoyed that dialogue back and forth because, first of all, we just love it, but also because it ended up making us better teachers, because we're thinking about some of the inner work of what we're doing. And so I think that's an important thing to remember, is we should be aligned with the research base, but that's not the same thing as using research as a tool to remove agency or judgment from classroom teachers, because that is also necessary.
Yeah, I agree that that agency from teachers, I think, is so critical. And it kind of gets to that whole, the art versus the science of teaching, right? Like you hit on both sides of it, is that science of it, that research is necessary, but then we need to be able to critically analyze that science and say, okay, that's what worked maybe in a lab setting, or maybe this is the conclusion they drew from that data. But if you look at the data a different way, it could mean this and it could mean that. And then the teacher has to make the ultimate choice for how to implement those things in their classroom.
Yeah, and that's a lot of stuff going on, right? Because and the whole time we've got, you know, 30 or 40 students waiting on us for the next thing, for whatever's going on next. And so that's a lot going on, but that's why I love our job. That's why I love this profession, is because that's hard, but it's satisfying work.
It is. You know, we talked a little bit before the podcast how I'm kind of in a more non-traditional role now and don't get as much face time in front of students. And that is definitely the part I miss, is that moment where there's 30 or 40 students waiting for you to come up with an answer to a question you weren't expecting. That improvisational nature of what we do so often. And I definitely miss some of that.
Yeah, I agree. I also talk about improv work pretty regularly because, the yes and principle, that's something the teachers can use. And so I remember fondly some of my improv drills with my students on occasion.
Excellent. Well, you kind of touched on it a little bit, but how did you guys end up starting a podcast where you drink a pint while talking about educational research? Like, how did that come about?
It was sort of a running joke in our department when we worked together at the high school level. He taught college biology and I taught AP biology. So we were kind of, we found ourselves working alongside each other a lot. And we would get into these arguments about, you know, sometimes really substantive philosophical issues, but sometimes the most trivial, like hilarious questions that we find ourselves on opposite sides. And so that's how we spend our lunch, is debating some of these nonsensical topics. And the rest of our department would joke and say, it doesn't take very much to set these two off debating something. So really what you need to do is just give them a couple of beers and turn on a tape recorder, and you probably get a pretty entertaining conversation, like no matter what they ended up talking about. And so that was a joke that got made a lot for a couple of years. And then when I decided to move to the University of Kansas for the job that I've taken now, leaving party at the end of the school year, that was Lawrence's gift to me, was he got out a couple of beers and he set out a tape recorder. He said, hey, let's do one, you know, let's see what happens. And so, in amongst, you know, our colleagues and our friends, and we were kind of laughing and having a good time with it, but we actually did spawn a couple of compelling debates just even right there in that moment. And so we kind of said, hey, maybe this is a way that we can continue our friendship, and maybe this is a way that we can continue to challenge each other professionally, is if we go ahead and start this show. And so we jumped in, we gave it a try.
Yeah, and it's been a good journey so far.
It has. It's really something that we reflect on pretty regularly. This paper really changed the way I do this thing, or it popped up in my practice because it mattered for this conversation. And sometimes it's stuff that's already happened, or sometimes it's drawing our attention to something that matters even, you know, a month or two later. And so it once we got started, noticing how impactful it was to have these deliberate, regular conversations just for our own personal practice was like, this is a thing we got to keep doing. This is really powerful professional development. So let's keep doing it. Plus, we both like to drink beer.
Well, yeah, I definitely I can empathize with all of those loves. I think I have many of the same ones myself.
So I got to make sure and get a recommendation from you before we leave then, so we can make sure we try something that you like.
Okay, I will. I'll put some thought into it as we're recording.
Yeah, here. Excellent.
Okay, so the other question I always like to ask, and I love people in your position, I always like to think about, so you now teach at the college level, and you previously taught at the public school level, the high school level. So what was that transition like for you?
It was a big one. It's one that I'm still kind of dealing with, even you know, a year and a half on from when I moved. It's, despite what, there are plenty of similarities, and I'm talking about, you know, I'm instructing others in the work that I was doing in the classroom before. So there's a lot of overlap in skills and experience, but the day-to-day goings on, it's a lot different moving from life between the bells to, we have a steam whistle on KU's campus. So I still get to know when my class is over, but I'm not, you know, living from first block to second block to third block anymore. And so that additional freedom has been really, really nice. I've gotten to pursue some areas of scholarship that I always thought that I might be interested in if I had an opportunity. So that's been really fun to be able to pursue some of my areas of passion a little bit more, with a little bit more dedication. But also it's weird because I don't feel the same sense of movement that you get from a day in, day out with students of like, oh man, we started this month. My students didn't know very much about, you know, the molecular basis of inheritance. And now we know so much. This is amazing. And I don't get that same sense of progression anymore just because we have fewer classes and I just have fewer students. And so it's been a transition to that, a different mentality from the secondary level to the post-secondary level. It's definitely been an adjustment.
I really like that. I'm really intrigued by that last point there about not getting the sense of movement, because you do, as a K-12 classroom teacher, you see growth over the course. I mean, if you're doing even one portion of your job, you see growth of students over the course of a school year. And not only for you condensing it down to the length of a semester instead of a school year, but then on top of that, seeing them less often. And I imagine that there's probably not, in my experience, at least I should say, I certainly didn't have the kinds of relationships with my college professors that I did with my high school and middle school teachers. So I imagine that there would be that disconnect. And I think I would struggle without that. I don't know. I think that would be a struggle for me to not have that every day.
Yeah. And that's actually one area where my particular program, I feel like we do a really good job of building relationships with our individual students as we go through, as they move their through the program. And so I know my students before my first day of class, and I get to stay in touch with them as they progress through the rest of the program and as they become professional teachers, because professional development is a part of my job as well. And so I really do get to know them pretty well, which is something that is not true in a lot of higher ed settings, as you mentioned. And so that's actually sort of the way that I get to make up for some of that missed opportunity is I don't have as many clock hours with my students as I have in the past. So I really get to lean more into the programmatic development that we do over the course of their degree to be able to get kind of that validation and that feedback that they really are getting better. So I feel like that's something that we do well, because if we didn't, I would be right there with you. I would have a hard time sort of feeling the value of what I do if I don't get to see them improving. So I feel really good that I found a spot where we get to see some of that in a way that is not often true.
Very cool. I like it. Well, we've been chatting here for a little bit, Michael, and I think I'm ready to get into my first question for you, because I have a feeling that you're going to have a really good answer for me. And we did talk before the show that you did not necessarily prepare for these questions, which I appreciate, because you have heard episodes of my show. So I appreciate that you didn't try to put a lot of thought into these questions, but I am curious where your head is at. So I'm going to go with my first question, which is, what is the biggest problem facing education today?
So I told you that before the show, and so I really held off on the other two, but I knew this one was coming, and I find this question compelling, and it begs risk-taking, I think, from people who have to answer this question. And so I hedge all of those to say I actually did put in a little bit of thought to this question, because it's such a big question that I was like, I don't... You know, how do you find an umbrella that can include the couple of things that I really think are important and where I focus in my professional development work? Or how do you pick something that's precise enough that that I'm willing to stand behind it as the biggest priority? And I really wrestled with that. And so I'm going to give it a shot. I don't know what this is going to come out like, but I say the word professionalism a lot. And I say that to mean two things simultaneously. I think that teachers should be empowered to execute their judgment in their classrooms in a lot of ways that we really have a hard time supporting at the systemic level. I really think it's important that teachers have the autonomy to make choices and to explore different curricular practices and to try and implement different research findings in a way that they think is appropriate for their setting. And all that is hard. And so they have to make calls that are sometimes ambiguous, or sometimes they don't pay off. I try something and it didn't work the way that I thought it was going to work. And I think that they need that space to be able to navigate those situations, because that's what it means to be a professional, is to execute their judgment. A surgeon is executing judgment when they operate on a patient. I know generally what a heart bypass looks like, but this particular patient has specific needs and specific unique characteristics that means I have to make a call while I'm here. And I know what the research says about that, but at the end of the day, I have to make a call. And I don't know that we have that same space broadly in the educational system for teachers to be empowered to make that call on a regular basis. And I think that we need that. That's something that I think we need to, I want to amplify that message that teachers need the autonomy to make calls and then reflect on the quality of those calls. And I think that administrators and politicians and communities really need to rally around and provide support for educators who are making those decisions while they're trying to do it, because it's really tough. We were even talking about that already. That's tough. And they need the support to be able to get better at doing that.
I will say professionalism has not been given as an answer previously.
Yeah.
But I think the way you're saying it, I like the way you're bringing that up, because when you said professionalism originally, my first thought is a series of teachers who I know at every school I've ever worked at who show up to school every day in yoga pants and or shorts and a t-shirt and then try to teach classes. And I regularly question that is not professional, and why would you do that? But I think you're right that you're coming at professionalism from almost a perspective of the outside in, which is that we don't get looked at as professionals and therefore are not given the space to do the things that a professional would do, which almost comes to this sort of cyclical cycle of we're not looked at as professionals, so we don't get the space we need. And then because we don't get the space we need, we don't get better to therefore be more professional. And then more people think we're not being professional. And it almost sort of a dog eating itself from the tail up, you know? So, I think I can agree. I think I can agree with that. You mentioned specifically politicians and administrators giving educators the space they need. Is that where you would point most directly to who needs to fix that problem, or who else might you point to, or what would you say is the solution to fixing that problem?
Well, and that's the trick. And that's why I debated whether I was even going to go this direction with the question, because as you mentioned, it is a cyclical problem. And so I would include in that umbrella, I said being reflective on our choices. And I think that's something that we as teachers can do a better job of, is we make calls, but then returning to the research base to see what does the research say about how I could approach that problem and how I could do it better in the future. And I think that when we don't do that, when we say, I just made a call and I just used my uninformed intuition, or I disregarded this piece of research for poorly justified reasons or whatever, when we just make choices and don't really think about how they impact, and then we don't improve over time the same way. And then that incentivizes people to deprofessionalize us, right? So if they're not going to be doing the things that professionals do, then we have to impose systems on them that are going to make them reduce these negative characteristics. And so I'm really hesitant to point a finger at any individual person because it's cyclical. And so each place provides reinforcement or feedback on each other spot in that system. And that's a big problem. So rather than pointing a finger, I'd rather just take responsibility for my piece of that. So I think from a professional development standpoint, I support classroom teachers. That's the primary thing that I do on a day in, day out basis. I think that professional development providers, people who blog, people who podcast, people who provide workshops, people who speak at conferences, people who tweet, I think literally anybody who has a hand in supporting other teachers in the classroom, that needs to be through the lens of providing them autonomy to make choices and then providing them resources to reflect on those choices. And then that can provide some positive push into that cycle. And then the other people can deal with whatever responsibility that they may have. I don't know that I'm willing to say that anybody is of to any more blame than anybody else, but I have some responsibility in that cycle, and I want to make it better at my spot. You know, I want to make it a little bit better.
It's a very personal view to take, and I think that's good, because it is not pointing the blame at other people. I think that's powerful, and I think it's a message that any of my listeners or anyone at all listening to this podcast could take from that, is that we do need to be more reflective. And I think the argument, the pushback you're going to get from educators, from teachers specifically, is that we don't have time to do that, which of course is always the trump card to avoid anything we don't want to do. But I think there is some value to that of, I tried this last year, it went fine, we're just going to do it again this year. I don't have time to develop something new because I've got to grade 150 kids' essays, and I've got to email back all these parents that are bothering me, and et cetera, et cetera. I've got to make lesson plans in triplicate, broken down by the minute, so my administrator knows exactly what they see when they walk in, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All the things that we throw out as overloading our plates. I think that would be the argument. And if a teacher says to you, I don't have time to reflect and to go back to the research when something does or does not work, what is your typical reply to that comment?
Yeah, because that's real. And I'm not going to argue with very many teachers about that, because I experienced that also. And I saw that happening. And that's true at every level, right? I even saw that at the administrator level, both district and building, where they've got so many demands placed on them that they literally cannot provide the feedback or implement things in a way that provides space, because there's just all these strictures that they just, institutional constraints is the word that we throw around a lot in my department. Institutional constraints that sort of forbid the kinds of growth that we're talking about. And so really, then that's the problem. So I would go with that teacher and say, what are the specific things? What's the stuff that's sucking up all this time? Let's find the one that's of least value, and let's find a way to reduce its burden on you. And I don't know what that's necessarily going to look like. If it can be movement to grading practices that are more sustainable, or if it can be finding a way to be relieved of some of those constraints that are nothing more than a burden and they don't lead to growth, can we reallocate that to something that is more conducive to their professional growth? And really, that conversation gets had with administrators. I think that's the spot where a teacher needs to loop in their assistant principals or their instructional coaches, the people who have the control over that, and say, hey, we got this professional development event coming up next month where we have a full day. Let's not do nonsense. Let's spend a day to reflect on this big thing. Let's dump 4 hours into it. Let's have a real conversation about that. Or let's spend time, hey, PLCs, I know that we have this this paperwork that's supposed to be going on, but I really think that if you can just forgive us from not doing this report once, can we spend a month just talking about this thing? And then you and I can talk again. I can tell you how valuable it was. Finding a way to work around those burdensome constraints and then show them that it really leads to growth is going to be what it takes. But I agree, we're too busy to do it on the face. So I think solving the busyness problem is really the trick.
So we come at this problem from two sides, and we have the external factor of people not looking at us professionally and then putting systems in place to manage that professionalism, which of course all of those systems require us putting more time and effort into meeting the needs of that system. Uh-huh. But then if we take away the reflection of the system, then teachers have more space to try things that might be better uses of their time and therefore lead to professionalism. And with so many problems, we end up with this sort of combating issue, right? Like, we end up with so many things. And I think, but I agree with you completely. I think that if we can combat the time, you know, we can go a long way. I actually think you made me think of Jethro Jones, and I don't know if you know him. He's another podcaster, runs a Leader of Learning podcast. Transformative Principal podcast. And he says, as a principal, his rule is he never does anything until he gets the first email that says, "Hey, you didn't get this done, and we need it." And he says, as a principal, that works out really well, because a lot of times they'll ask for things that never actually need to be done. And I think that sometimes that same mentality can be applied for a classroom teacher, where you may get asked to do something, and if you don't do it, no one really notices. And I think sometimes that teachers need to consider that when they're looking at what is worth their time and what's taking their time. I think that a lot of initiatives and pushes come from above and beyond and outside and other directions. And they're not all as critical as all the other ones. And especially when you can't directly point to how this is going to benefit your students, I tend to wait till I get the first email that says, hey, you were a bad boy, go get this done. And that's usually when I try to knock some of those things out.
Yeah, and that's especially, I work with young teachers. So in that conversation, I'm usually like, you need to feel out your political climate at your building also, because I would imagine there's probably a wide breadth in how different administrators would respond to those kinds of policies. But a little bit of judgment on which things we're being asked to do or the things that need to be prioritized is definitely one piece of it. And really, I feel like in this whole conversation, what we have to talk about is also what happens at the second level. What's the second step in all of this? Because it's easy to say, try things. It's easy to talk about that. But then if you think about, I'm going to try something in my classroom, well, of course, I'm already imagining some of my students are going to do that really well, and some of my students are going to make some mistakes. Some of them are good ones, and some of them are silly mistakes. And I think the same thing can happen with these sorts of freedom policies. Of if I'm going to give space and say, hey, PLC is a free-for-all this month. Go do some professional learning, whatever that means to you. There's going to be some groups that do really cool, really productive stuff. And usually there's going to be at least one group that does not do cool or productive stuff, and they abuse that policy a little bit. And so I think it's important to recognize that, especially while we're making cultural changes, there are going to be mistakes and there are going to be bumps in the road. And so being prepared to navigate those bumps and those challenges rather than being reactive to them and saying, oh my gosh, well, that didn't work. Okay, everybody's back on reports. Like, we're undoing that. Take away that freedom because it clearly doesn't work. I think being prepared to navigate the bumps in the road of transition is important, because if you're not, you know, mentally prepared for that, if you haven't built a framework to deal with that and help people make better choices and help people reflect on their ability to be reflective, then you can end up with just, you know, swinging back the other direction. And I think that's kind of dangerous also. So letting teachers execute that judgment on how am I going to deal with this, and then giving them feedback on here's how good your judgment was, so they can do it a little better next month or next opportunity, is, I think, an important piece of that whole decision-making process.
I could not agree more. I often struggle with the district in which I work, where I feel like our slogan is baby or bathwater. It's kind of how we tend to run things, is they try something for a year and it doesn't go perfectly or it goes poorly, and they just say, okay, well, we're going to 180 and toss everything about that out and do something that's completely the opposite of it. And that is it leaves a lot of us in whiplash, because we're trying to do the thing 1 year and then we completely change directions the next year. But it's not a true reflective process. It's looking at only the results and saying, well, the results weren't what we wanted, so trash everything. And it doesn't begin to try to dissect the complexities of a complete plan or a complete idea in the way that we really need to see. So I could not agree more. And in fact, it nicely leads to what I was going to ask as my other follow-up, because you said that a professional as an educator should do something, try something in their classroom, and then go to the research and look at what the best practices are. And as I said, your show specifically focuses on sort of the concrete of that. So I'm actually curious, what does the reflective process look like for you when you try something new and then go to the research? How does that look for you? What does that look like? Because I always say, like, oh yeah, check the research, but I don't even begin to know what that actually means.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. You say this thing, what does that thing actually look like? So kudos, that is a good follow-up question. I feel fortunate. I graduated from the program for which I work now. I graduated from UCAN Teach a number of years ago. And so in my early pre-service training, I got a good foundation built on a couple of best practices that I still think are persuasive. I still think active learning, inquiry-based, student-centered approaches are important. I think collaboration is important. I think communication skills are important. And so kind of from that framework, I put together some new lesson. I mean, this happened even last week. I was doing a brand new lesson that was some revised curriculum from how we'd done things in the past. And so implementing that based on my synthesis of my, you know, my broad research base is sort of step one. And so I'm going to execute some judgment. I'm going to try something. And then after that process, I think really thoughtful and precise and critical reflection is my common next step. So like I actually had a couple of our students observe me. They were TAs, not in that particular class. And I said, hey, will you sit down and just collect data? Just write down things that you see in the classroom for me so that I can look at it when I'm done. Cause this is a new lesson that I'm doing. And they, of course, were willing to do that. And so being able to look closely and not just say, hey, that generally felt good, or not say, hey, generally that felt bad, but really getting precise about what were the things that worked and what were the moments that weren't as effective as they could be, and then finding those spots where they weren't as effective as they could be. And that's the spot where I'm going to go looking, where I'm going to say, okay, who does something like this and they do it better than I do, so that I can then see what they do differently to try and revise how I approach this for next time. And so that's the spot where, like, I've got a journal sitting on my desk. And so I sit down and do retrieval practice after all of the new instruction or the new, like, meeting discussions. Anytime I have moments of new, I sit down and do a retrieval practice. I make sure that it is at least one day later. And I sit down and just write, what do I remember? And so it gives me a chance to kind of wash out a lot of the emotional reaction that I've had and just see what were the memories that stuck. Like, oh yeah, that question really did fall flat because I still remember that. And so I kind of write what I remember about that moment. Or yeah, I think that this was the headline from my class. If I really reflect on what did they get out of it, was that intentional and was that well supported with the things that I planned? And so that retrieval process helped me kind of prioritize what I think the big pieces were from that piece of implementation. And then I take that and go and I do some literature search against the things that I think I might know about how broadly we ought to be doing those things to then write down some revisions. And so then I update those curriculum materials then. Like, I don't wait until the next time I'm going to do it, but I at least make comments, if not actually do the revisions while it's still fresh in my mind. So then whenever it comes around next semester or next school year, it is already updated so that I don't have to worry about trying to remember things that are a year old. So I can just start the process new. Let's see, how does this one go and where are the rough spots this time?
Yeah, I like that. I particularly like the retrieval pack component, the retrieval practice component. I think that's really interesting to be able to, like you said, give the day and let the emotional component go. Because I know for me, when I run a lesson, I'm always on an adrenaline high right afterwards. And even when I taught in the classroom 5 days a week, I still had that, you know, by the end of the day, I was feeling good about how the day had gone. And then often a day or two later, I would realize by test results or some sort of, you know, formative monitoring that they did not get what I thought they did, even though I felt really great about the lesson. So I think the retrieval practice would have been a valuable strategy for me as well. And I think that's awesome. I was actually just talking to one of my new teachers that I'm a mentor for, and I actually said something similar to her. I said, you know, you should take whatever resources you used, whatever PowerPoints or activities or whatever, and the day after or the immediately after, just put notes on it of this worked, this didn't work, plus minus system, something like that. Or every day do, you know, I told her to split a page in two thirds. So you had two thirds on the top and a third on the bottom. And it should be two thirds of good things that happened that day and a third of the bad things. And that at least next year, if you don't have time to do it now, at least next year, when you get back to this unit, you have it there and ready to go of, okay, this worked well, this didn't, and these are the things I need to adjust. So I agree. I think that that's a feasible process for educators to go through for various assignments and activities. I think it's realistic to ask us to do that.
Yeah. And the thing that's maybe is hard for me sometimes, and I think is why being in each other's classrooms is such a big piece of that. Having some observer who isn't the person as the lead instructor is such a valuable piece of that, is because finding something to improve every time can be tricky, especially when I'm like, oh, I feel like I nailed it. Oh, that felt great. Like I had a new example that I used and it was amazing and everybody responded to it and it was awesome. So I'm thinking about last week again, and my observing students, I was like, man, that example worked. This was great. And I looked at their notes, and right after that example, my next transition question, they're like, that was confusing. That didn't make any sense to me. And I was like, oh, they're right. That was a rocky transition, and I kind of forgot about it because I had these rose-colored glasses on from feeling so good about that other example. And so I think that discipline of saying nothing is very few things are all bad, right? Man, that example didn't land. I feel like this was just a big dumpster on fire. I don't know, Rome was burning today. So really pushing yourself to find, like, was the lesson bad? Is it philosophically flawed, or are there just many implementation changes to make? And then the vice versa is also true. Was that the perfect lesson? Probably not. I could probably find a way to really find some detail that I can improve. And that's really tricky when you're on your own. So I think for you and me, being in the support position, being able to model that, let's get other eyes on it, let's get other input on it, is an important piece of that to keep it productive over the long term. So I know, like, even when I was at the high school level, but much more so now that I'm training pre-service teachers, letting the students behind the curtain is a great way to do some of that. Of like, hey, I'm trying this thing. How did it go? What did you think about it? What worked and what didn't? Because I've been really pleasantly surprised how much the students will be honest with you if they see that you are engaging that process authentically. Like, hey, I made this suggestion and he actually did things differently when we did this the next time. Cool. I'm gonna make more suggestions. So I think getting external observations, even from students in the class, can be a nice way to make sure that we are prioritizing things appropriately and avoiding that risk of rose-colored glasses or the opposite, that everything was terrible when there are some good things in there.
Yeah, I think I agree. I think we definitely could do a better job as educators across the board, just not speaking at any one person in general, but just across the board, of sort of not pretending that we're Oz, taking that step back, letting someone behind the curtain and saying, I am human. I'm going to make a mistake. Let me see how this goes, mm-hmm. And I, from my own practice, when I started saying things like that to my students, I gained a lot more insight into what they were doing and why things I was doing were or were not working. So I think for sure that we could all probably do a better job of opening the curtain, as it were.
Yeah, but it's tough. It's tough sometimes because I get nervous or I'm not sure exactly how it's going to go. So, we all got to do it at our own pace.
Yeah, absolutely. Awesome. Well, I like it. Well, we took like 20 minutes on that question, so but I think you gave us a thorough response. I do appreciate that. I think you gave us a well-reasoned response with some concrete information in there. So I think it was good. I appreciate that. And I'm just going to steamroll directly into my next question without transition and say, what is something that you're doing that you wish all educators would do?
Oh my gosh. Wow. Okay. That's a hard question. That's a hard question because there are a lot of things that I do that I really like and that I think are effective, but that there are very few things, going with that autonomy theme, like each teacher should be able to make their own choices. And so there are not a lot of things I'd be willing to say everybody should do. Mindfulness about how we implement things in the classroom and what justifications we have for our choices is maybe the best answer that I can give to that. That's a really tough one because what's right for me is definitely wrong for others. We talked about that improvisational spirit that we've got, and that's not true of everybody. Like, I have specific colleagues who I know do a great job, but their comfort is derived from their planning. They are very uncomfortable with an improv perspective on the class. And so I wouldn't want them to do that. You can be responsive while still doing lots of planning. So I think having that thoughtful approach to why am I doing what I do? What are my justifications? What are my priorities? And how are the things that I'm doing serving my priorities? I think is the best that I can do. And so if each of us is thinking about what are the choices I'm making and why am I making them and not just letting things happen to us, then I think that we're going to be able to get better over time. And I think we're going to be able to better serve students. But I also think a lot of teachers are already doing that. I don't think that that's unique to me.
It's interesting to me that you would go with that because it almost seems contradictory to the improvisational nature of a classroom, because sometimes you're just saying yes and then the next thing that pops out isn't always completely well-reasoned or thought through or, yeah. You don't necessarily know why you say that thing. And at the same time, your first question really looks at the reflective post-teaching component of teaching. And then your answer to the second question looks at sort of the pre-planning component of it. So you're coming at it from both sides on this one. I appreciate that. what does that process look like for you? You know, you make it, you know, you need to do something. What does that planning component look like for you to be able to say, I know why I'm doing this and this is it?
I'm trying to imagine planning, and I can think of several colleagues who are already laughing at the notion of exactly what my planning process looks like. Picking the broad priorities, like what is our target for growth, whether that be in professional development or whether that be in a classroom at the university or a classroom at the high school. I think picking what is my target for growth broadly, what is the skill that I'm trying to develop, and what's the content knowledge I'm trying to develop by exercising that skill, is the first step. Like, that's why am I doing what I'm doing today? But then after that, what are the major processes I'm going to employ in service of that priority? So we're going to build a simulation today. That's generally how we're going to approach it. And we're going to work on this particular experimental example. The big bullet points in what I'm going to do, but then I try to resist the urge to get to any finer grain of planning than that. These are the three bullet points that I think I can hit in this hour of work. We're going to do some retrieval practice, and then we're going to discuss this example and try and make some kind of claims or draw some conclusions. And then we're going to see about synthesizing our own examples. And that's three bullet points. I only really believe we're going to get to two of them because I overplanned, ironically. And then from there, we'll see what actually happens. And sometimes all that goes right out the window, like with the first 3 minutes, right? So it's not that I do zero planning, but I think my goal is to try and take responsiveness to such a level that it is entirely plausible that everything goes in the trash can in the first 2 minutes. You know, students walk in and they say, hey, I was walking in here and I saw a moth outside doing this weird thing. What's the deal with that? And I'm like, you know what? That moth behavior is also related to that broad priority I had. So heck, whatever it is I had planned, that's in the garbage. Let's go check out that moth, and we're gonna see where that goes. And so I think having a clearly articulated high level priority lets me make those judgment calls in a way that I wouldn't be comfortable with if I was like, we're doing this simulation example is my purpose. Well, that doesn't have any room to flex. That doesn't have any room to do other things if the students have an alternative interest. And so I think being able to start with a crystallized high level goal lets me know that what I have in mind with this particular example serves that goal. But if other things come up that could also serve that goal, we'll do that also. And I think that's where that improvisational flavor comes out of like, hey, we're in a coffee shop, but what happens in that coffee shop is going to be totally determined by whatever's going on with the interactions that we have.
I guess it would help if I unmuted my mic. I can see that. And it's kind of an odd combination of planning and improvisation, but I can get it. And I think I can also imagine many of my own colleagues laughing if I had been asked what my planning process looks like. Actually, I can imagine my fiance laughing at me if someone were to ask me what my planning process looks like, because I don't have one of those. But yeah, I see what you mean, where it's kind of those broad, big picture ideas, and then letting sort of the specifics of how you get there come more naturally is a powerful way to instruct, I think. So I think that's good. I think it's good. I'm curious, do you feel like you used the word sort of broad educational base or broad reading base earlier, of sort of knowing the foundational components of good education and educational research. Does that give you the space to make better decisions on the fly? Do you think that's something that is a necessary prerequisite of being able to make those on the fly decisions?
I love that question, because I have an answer to that question. I think the answer is yes. I think the answer is a resounding yes. Especially early on, you know, I work with pre-service teachers on the day-to-day basis, and if you don't have much experience, being able to make those calls is a lot harder, because you don't really know what might come out of the conversation, and you don't have as deep of an example base or as deep of a maybe a skill base of the different ways you can approach something. And so you're going to be less flexible while you're still developing that experience. And so I think having both feet planted on these are the core principles, these are the core tenets of how I go about doing it, can help inform the ways that different topics or different activities might serve a similar goal from different perspectives. For example, Glasser's choice theory is a huge deal for me. Like, if a student, I can't make a student do anything. That makes it so much easier if students are opting out of something, say, okay, what will you opt into? What other questions do you have? Or what other ways to approach this might you want to engage with? Because I can't make you do it. And so I need to be responsive in this moment because you are executing choice at the end of the day in this moment. And so I think Neil will say, like, we are collaborative. We are inquirers. Are nice ways to provide that framework for I can quickly make some structural decisions about how I might go about engaging in this new lesson direction without spending a lot of time having to do much hand-wringing over, like, what does that look like? Well, I've done enough practice with collaborative learning that I feel pretty comfortable just whipping that up, you know, just on the fly, just in a given moment. Whereas if I was trying to do things from the bottom up, if I was trying to build an individual lesson based on external examples and without that fundamental grounding in the theory, then it's much harder to generalize those things to new examples. Like, I know what this lesson looked like, but I don't really know what a different lesson would look like because I don't know how that first one came to be. And so I think that grounding in the broad educational theory gives me a fresh, solid starting point for making new decisions on the fly.
Would you say that the majority of educators have that broad understanding of educational research?
I wouldn't say, because I do not have the data to address that question.
I feel like that's a bit of a cop-out to that question.
It absolutely is a cop-out. But I do not want to generalize for my fellow professionals. I can think of specific examples of people who do not have that theoretical grounding, and I can think of plenty of examples of people who do have that theoretical grounding. So I really don't know. I feel like I need to acknowledge my own ignorance on that one.
Okay. I'll let you slip by on that one. I won't hold you down on that one. awesome. Well, I like that. I think that I agree with you in terms of that theoretical grounding being critical. I think that is an important thing. It is definitely something that I wish I did more of, that I had more experience in, having sort of fallen into education backwards and not gone through school for education. I always feel like I am lacking in that space. But I do see the value in it. And I feel like I'm playing catch up by doing research and things like that now, having not done it previous to teaching. But I do try to.
I feel that way also. I also feel like I'm still playing catch up because there's so much to get good at.
Well, I'm glad I'm not alone.
You are not.
So excellent. Well, I want to roll to my last question because I've asked you the hard ones. I've hit you with the tough stuff. I feel like I gave you a little bit of a softball on that last one. I kind of knew you were going to say, yes, you needed the foundation, but that's okay. We gave you a softball. But I will go into my last question for all my guests, which is, who is the best teacher you have ever had?
So that's a really tricky question for me because I've had my mother as a teacher twice. So I feel like I need to just immediately disqualify her because whether she was or was not, you know, that kind of sullies the question. So Mom, you do a great job. She was the Kansas Teacher of the Year a few years ago. So, like, you do a great job. You are not in the running for this question. You're out. So instead, I really think that the best teachers that I had, I mean, you know, I had an AP calculus teacher in high school who really opened my eyes to what real math looks like. And I really appreciated that experience. My AP biology course with my mother is clearly mattered to me because that is where I have landed professionally. But if I'm going to pick one, my You Can't Teach teachers when I was an undergraduate literally changed the course of my life. I was a biochemistry undergraduate who did not care about his biochemistry work, which was sad. And I was feeling kind of professionally lost. You know, my grades were not good because I just wasn't investing in what I was doing. And I genuinely have no idea what I would have ended up doing had I not come across this program that sort of ticked all the boxes of like, this is what I think education ought to be. And they're like, you're right, as a matter of fact, and here's the research to back it up, and here's how you can go do that for a living. And I you know, the rest is history, so to speak. Jan LeRiviere is the name that I quote so often, but Steve Case, Brad Williamson, Margie Hill, Carol Williamson, those master teachers giving me that theoretical foundation upon which I could build a career. There's just no way to understate how impactful that's been for my life. So the example that they set is one that I'm still trying to live up to. And I feel like, you know, that also feels a little questionable because I work in that program now. But I feel like the answer would be the same even if I didn't work in that program, because that's just, if I'm picking the one spot that was the most disruptive to my life and the most impactful for who the person I have become and who I am becoming, that's the answer.
Interesting. You know, I always say that with that question, it's never the content or that the material that is the things that people remember. And yet for you, it kind of is. So there are, you know, there are exceptions. For you, it is actually the content and the material which led to the career and the life that you have. So I think that's nice. I think that's good that you can be an exception to my normal answer to that question. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, I'm weird in all sorts of ways, so that doesn't surprise me at all.
Absolutely. Well, I think we've covered a lot of topics here today. I think we've gotten through a lot, and I really appreciate your time. I really, really do. And I think that you gave a great combination of sort of theoretical understanding and sort of high philosophy, but with some actual concrete actionable things. You know, I really like the retrieval practice after a lesson. I think that's a great idea. And I think we all probably need to spend a little more time with our foundational base. And you also talked about that as support, one of the things we need to always be doing is all of our support for other teachers should be in service of their own autonomy. And I thought that was a powerful message as well. So I really appreciate your time, Michael. I really do. Thank you for joining me today.
Hey, thanks for having me. I think that being able to talk with other educators candidly and honestly is the way that we get better. So I appreciate what you do in having conversations with educators. And I think that it's something on which we should spend our time. So thank you for having me. And I appreciate this conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. So for my audience, if they would like to get a hold of you, how can they find you? And of course, your podcast as well.
Yeah. I'm on Twitter. I am at Ralph CSTEM at Ralph CSTEM. And our podcast, Two Pint PLC is located at twopintplc.com. We release once a month, and we try to do more of this. I think that trying to connect research and the theoretical foundations with actual real classroom application is something that doesn't happen enough. We got to make the connections because we're all trying to work with real students on a day-to-day basis. And so this needs to be useful. And so that I think that that's what we try to do every month. So if you want to get in touch with us or you want to hear more about this kind of thing, check us out. We're on all the distribution platforms or go to our website and you can see what it is we're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I definitely listen. So I highly recommend the Two Pint PLC as a good combination of actual theoretically grounded research, which is very nice because, like I said, I'm always behind and I feel like you guys help me catch up, which is wonderful. And you really can't go wrong with two guys drinking a beer in front of a microphone. So I don't see how you can lose there either. So Michael, again, I really appreciate your time. Thank you, man.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me. Have a good one, man.
Michael, thank you again for being on the show. I really look forward to working with you and the Two Pint PLC more. To connect with Michael, you can find him on Twitter. He's at Ralph C. Stem. And you can also find the Two Pint PLC at twopintplc.com or, of course, wherever you listen to podcasts. And links to both of those are on the show. If you have comments or questions about the show, you can always connect with me on Twitter or Instagram. I'm at Brad Shuffler. I'd love to hear from you there, especially if you'd like to be a guest on the show in an upcoming episode. Or you can check out the feedback page on my website, which gives you additional options for feedback as well, which you can find at bradshuffler.com/feedback, or click the link in the show notes. Until next week, go out and support teachers in service of their autonomy. Music for the Planning Period podcast is the song Vicious by Kevin MacLeod, used under Creative Commons. You can find him at incompetech.com. The Planning Period podcast is also a proud member of the VoiceEd Radio Network, a 24-hour radio network all about education all the time. VoiceEd Radio, your voice is right here.